This is Critical Edge. I'm Ollie. I'm here with my co-host Lucas. We're here to learn how to think, not what to think. Today, we're here with Councillor George Finch. We're going to refer to you as George from now on. Hope that's okay.
That's perfectly fine.
George, for anyone who doesn't know you, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, maybe in 20 words or less?
Yeah, so I'm George Finch, the leader of Warwickshire County Council. Live in Warwickshire, represent the ward of Bedworth Central, got the biggest majority in Warwickshire for a Reform UK councillor. But it's been a tough few months.
It's been intense.
Yeah, very much so. Getting elected on May 1st, we didn't know necessarily if we would get a majority or whether we'd be in minority or just thrown into opposition. Going from a standing start to then winning 23 councillors, four from the south and the rest from the north, was a massive victory for us. And then going through leadership debates, actually winning the council back in May, and then having to go up again in July with myself to be elected as the leader of the council, and we won. It just goes to show that the people of Warwickshire want reform, and we won't stop, and we won't let anyone else take that from us, because that is what the people voted for. So there's no point of having a Lib Dem, Labour, Green, crazy rainbow coalition that ends up blowing up after the first few weeks. It reforms the stable party in Warwickshire.
Yeah, so it's interesting, actually, because, you know, Reform has had quite a lot of success in different councils. And you've only been in the game for a short amount of time, certainly only council lead, like you said, for a few months. It's been tough. But for the podcast, we were doing a talk yesterday at a school, and we mentioned that we were going to be interviewing you today. A couple of them didn't recognise you by name, but then I said, you know, oh, the council lead of Warwickshire, and they recognised you. So there's a lot of Reform UK councillors winning across the country, and yet you seem to be a recognisable name. Why do you think that is? What's the appeal?
Well, I think, obviously, the headlines of youngest council leader, obviously, went everywhere, everyone saw it, you know. But for me, it's not about age. You know, don't judge me on my age, judge me on my ability and what we do. We've only been there for 4 or 5 months. So, you know, getting your feet under the table, learning your brief as portfolio holder for children and families, you have to understand all the ins and outs of the portfolio. So that's why, you know, the first few months is finding your feet, getting to know the officers, where to go, what to do. And then you can start changing policy and changing the way the councils run.
What would people not know about councils running a council that you've learned since being a council leader? What are the interesting things that are different that are also important that people should know?
I think what people need to realise when becoming a councillor is that it's not simple. It's not something that you can just do on the side. It's a lot of responsibility, especially when having a portfolio, or if you want to be a good councillor, you have to put time and dedication to it, speaking to residents as well. Once you get elected, you can't just, you know, thanks for your vote and never be seen again. You have to be actively out there speaking and engaging with your residents, because they won't vote you in again. So you have to be that councillor that's seen, that is known. And to be honest with you, that's what our reform councillors are doing in Warwickshire, getting known, getting seen, doing things in the community, because that's the most important part about being a councillor. But the things that obviously most people wouldn't know is that, you know, like in Whitehall, you have civil servants in council, you have officers, and you work with your officers to make sure things get done. We're the strategical direction force of the council. That's what councillors do. We change the direction, policy change, so on, and the officers can provide you with that information. Things that I'm looking at doing already, you know, that they're really excited about working with us. And we did think that when we first got in that there may be some butting of heads, but that's normal when you get into a new organisation with new policies, new way of life. Some people don't want the change, but you have to bring those people with you. And that's what they've realised, not just in Warwickshire, but all across the country when it comes to working with reform.
Yeah, I mean, 19, Ollie and I were similar age, right? Early 20s. Life's kind of, it comes quick, no? If you're there in that position suddenly, and I think you spoke about this a little bit in the Telegraph interview, but all of a sudden, is there a lot of pressure to handle all these different things, this butting of heads? I know right before the interview you said you've got a thick skin, but what's that like, maybe on a human level?
Yeah, well, look, when you start council, you think, right, let's do what's right for yeah. your electoral division.
Yeah, of course.
You know, let's get that right. But then you get hurled into administration, and then you're actually responsible of running the council. Mm. And it, you know, a big wake up call for councillors all across the country, and it always is in any other party, not just Reform. But when you start getting your feet under the table and learning the brief, then that's when you start making those changes. And you'll always get attacks, you know, off of the councillors, off the public that they didn't vote for you, that might not like your politics, or not might may not like your style. But that's where you have to, you know, and this is what I've said before, is it has to be water off a duck's back. You entered politics to make change, but there are going to be people that disagree with you, but that's life. And that's the problem. That's what I've got a huge problem with, is it's too much feeling. I feel this, feel that. Just get on with your job, have broad shoulders, water off a duck's back. That's what you need to start doing. And that's what Reform councillors do best. Mm. Get to the nitty gritty stuff, bricks and mortar, you know, bread and butter type policies. Make sure that they're done correctly, then everything else will follow.
And it's your experience with education to some extent, isn't it, that got you into politics as well? Higher education, right?
Mm.
Tell us about that. What's wrong with the system?
So,
is it there's a lack of technical training, for example? That's a good place to start, right?
There's problems with the education system that can't be fixed overnight, because it's been decades where it's just been allowed to fester and fail.
What's been allowed to fester? So
what's been allowed to fester and fail is the attitudes in schools, with the society that's built within schools, that has been allowing A-levels and university degrees to take advantage of the job market. And that's where, in places like North Warwickshire, places like Neath and Bedworth, where I'm from, apprenticeships need to be at the forefront of making great change. And that's what I want to push in Warwickshire, and better apprenticeships for working class people, because they are the ones that can really make those changes and understand how it works at the bottom of society and work the way up. That's what we want to do in Warwickshire.
Yeah, my dad is German. He did an apprenticeship in Germany and it served him so well.
Mm.
It served him so well to today. He's the guy who can fix anything around the house, because he's had that experience when he was younger. And I think when I look at the UK system, I think, you know, getting more technical training, polytechnics, more focus on that rather than, you know, you need to go to uni, you need to go to uni. I think there's a mindset shift that I really actually agree with you on in some ways. I don't know, how does that happen? How do we make a shift, let's say, from people who go to uni and doss about for 3 years to saying we need to get things maybe a bit more organized?
Yeah, so Reform's policy during the general election was to decrease the university years from 3 to 2. Now, that makes a more streamlined, more proper education. You know, I went to uni only a short amount of time, but when I was there, you know, you were in not really 3 days a week, you know, and the kids were turning up on
Many
Thursday.
People are in zero, I think, is the main thing, right? Yeah. We're talking about apprenticeships, but, you know, I know a lot of people who've just gone to uni, and you may show up to a lecture here and there, and then ChatGPT, an exam.
Yeah,
but these are technical details, right?
But it's important. Well, no, it's not, because it's been allowed to happen, and it's an attitude problem. I go to university they go clubbing on a Wednesday night, they've got lecture on a Thursday. Oh, no, they don't turn up, they've got a hangover. No, hard work is the way to go forward. If you're on an apprenticeship and you turned up the next day with a hangover, you'd be told off by the gaffer and you'd feel embarrassed and you'd have to work overtime. That's the difference. And that's where you can actually change the attitude of especially young lads in working class backgrounds from going into hands-on apprenticeships, plumbing, carpentry. Those industries are on the decline and they need the support. And we've got a strategy on how to do that. We just have to get it over the line, and we're working with officers to get that done. And we've got a great opportunity in my town to actually begin creating an institute of sorts where it is more apprenticeship focused.
In my day-to-day job, right, I work as a salesman, but for an engineering company. So every day I'm in the factories working on the ground with the apprentices, graduate engineers, operators who maybe don't have formal education at all. And I don't know if it's necessarily true that they can't get hungover the night before. I think you'd be surprised. I think it's maybe more a trend of the average 20-year-old guy who just likes having 6 pints the day before. And I don't know if it's necessarily something which they can't do, or if it's something that's only unique to university.
No, I never said it was.
Yeah.
I'm saying if you did that at an apprenticeship and you didn't turn up, you turned up late,
right,
you'd be getting a telling off by the gaffer. Mm. At uni, you have that flexibility. That's that. You know, that's the. That's what I said. So that's the difference, and it's not just about universities. It's A levels as well. We're seeing a lot of young lads, a lot of young girls as well. That and most of them have got SEND needs, maybe ADHD, low level autism, and they don't tend to do well doing algebra or science. And you're thinking, well, how do we make sure that they actually get a good life? You know, they're not just stuck on benefits or unemployment benefits. You know, what can we do to make sure that they have the best future? And we do that by giving them the chance of apprenticeships. You know, I was in a ward, Galley Common, and there was a horse paddock, and they were getting children from primary schools that weren't doing the grade they should have been doing because they had autism and so on. What they were doing was teaching them how to paint a fence. Or instead of algebra and maths in a class, they were teaching kids how many carrots would you feed a horse with for the weight of the horse. And it, you know, it's that practical learning with hands-on that changes the perception of education for children. That's how you deal with the problem. It's not a fix overnight, but if you start primary schools, secondary schools, those children that don't get the GCSEs, you take them out of A level or uni that way, bring them into apprenticeship schemes. That's the best way forward. And those children that can, again, it all goes back to Tony Blair when he literally opened the door for universities, got rid of polytechnics, made them universities, and it just allowed more people to get into uni that probably shouldn't. And probably should have gone down an apprenticeship route. Mm. And it happens in life after 20, 30 years, the pendulum changes from left to right, from going from one way, that's when we need to do apprenticeships in the 50s, 60s, factory work, then in the early 2000s, more university A levels, then it's going back again. So it's just that natural trend.
Britain is like, it is primarily, you know, a service-based country as well, right? So I think like the fact that a lot more people are going to university, which by the way, I still agree with you on the technical points of making it more effective. But I think generally the move towards university has been a good thing. Wouldn't you agree?
I'm not saying it's not, but what I'm saying is that like, look at Warwickshire County Council, we need way more social workers, right? And university takes 3 years, then they have to have more training. What I'm saying is, would you not rather get a young lad, a young girl that is going through an apprenticeship, working hands-on, being a social worker, learning from more experienced people on the ground. Mm. I think you'd find a better class of social workers there that actually understand those needs of the people. Because most social workers, if they were from apprenticeships, have probably lived in the same background as the people that are actually in social care. So it's about understanding those things. And I think that's why apprenticeships can bridge a lot of those gaps that we're finding on councils. And especially when it comes to foster carers, there's a lack of those, a lack of social workers. And that's where I think apprenticeships can really solve that problem. It won't solve doctors or teachers. I'm not saying that. You have to go and do your degrees and get your things for that. Not saying that. But when it comes to skills like I think social workers would be a good one where you could learn on the ground. It's those type of things that we could really benefit from apprenticeship schemes.
Yeah, I think we're mostly agreed there. The other point I think for education with you is like the intellectual climate at universities. You've said you weren't a fan of the intellectual climate at university. Maybe free speech is the problem. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, what I found at uni...
Let's start with free speech, yeah.
What I found at university was that if you had a certain political affiliation, you couldn't disclose it. If you would, I think it would be hell to pay. You know, you'd rather sit down, head down, do your degree. You know, there's no point of creating a reform society in certain unis because it's just gonna get hounded. And we want to make sure that our supporters and our people are safe. But that's the thing. People won't want to express because they instantly get slammed down and shouted down. And that's not fair. That's not freedom of speech. Now, would we do
that? Do you see a parallel with, for example, because you're pro-free speech with universities in general, right, for example. But you complained about, for example, the frequency of Palestine protests at university. Isn't there an equivalence that, because, you know, Palestine protesters have a lot of run-ins with the police and so on, and, you know, that should be allowed to happen as well, shouldn't it? And yet you didn't seem keen on it when you're at university. Protesting for Palestine or expressing a view in support of reform. These are two sides of the same coin, right? And yet you're not keen for one when it comes to free speech, and you are keen for the other.
No.
There's a bit of an imbalance, right?
Protesting, perfectly fine. Locking the door of a lecture and in effect holding the lecture hall hostage and stopping the learning of multiple students, I think that's crossing the line. And then causing criminal damage on the university campus by graffitiing all across the walls, think that's crossing the line. Do you think a reform society would do that? Or they'd just try and promote their political beliefs?
Well,
I doubt they would. And that's the difference.
Well, hold on. If you don't mind, I mean, like, this is not to say that this is the policy of reform at all, but, you know, pro-Palestine protesters don't necessarily represent a cause as a whole. And on the other side, for example, so they may have done, you know, for example, criminal damage. Criminal damage has been done in protests which contain loads of reform supporters as well. And so
that's the thing.
Two sides of the same coin, right?
No, because there's bad eggs in every group. That's life. Mm-hmm. But when you go and do that and hinder people's educations, and then you come into our lecture and then you say, we're going to do another protest, disturb the whole lecture hall. Fine, I get it. Didn't care about that. And then when the actual lecturer stands up and goes, everyone write to the chancellor of the university and tell the chancellor to write to the police to get the people released that did the criminal damage. I think that's a bit too far. That's not common sense. That's not fair. And that's not fair on everybody in those lecture halls. Do you know how it started?
Isn't that lecturer expressing free speech though?
No. Look.
By asking you to do that.
This is the point. Universities are meant to, if I stood up and then said, no, I don't think that's right, what do you think would happen? Do you think you'd get a bit of chat?
It's not the worst thing in the world, is it?
No, but this is the point, is that you are not allowed to express certain beliefs at universities because you have got a certain political affiliation. And that needs to change. And it's not just in universities. That's a different kettle of fish because you are meant to have freedom of speech, freedom of expression, freedom of thought. And whatever you believe, don't care. You don't care if I support reform. I don't care if you've got a Labour society. But this is my point. Imagine if we, when they do freshers events and you've got all the little societies, just imagine if there was a reform one. Do you know what I mean?
I've seen like pro-abortion ones. It's in Oxford, maybe one of the, you might say the wokest, with many pro-abortion stands.
That's exactly.
But you do have this kind of thing. There's a conservative society where we went to uni, for example, which is ginormous. Yeah. And there's loads of reform supporters in there. They don't get hounded. There might be people who don't like them, right?
Maybe now reform will come as a...
I think they'll defect to make their own one.
I wouldn't be surprised that would be kind of accepted.
I think the thing is that the attitudes and people's political affiliations have changed quite recently and quite dramatically. So there is going to be that new change that's being seen in universities where reform will start popping up, that it will be new. And then when you've got old political parties, they'll be like, oh, there's a new kid on the block. Let's not. Do you know what I mean? And that's just life. But it's not just about unis. You know, we can't just get solely stuck onto universities because it's other education establishments, sixth forms and secondary schools and even primary schools, which I've seen. I've read their curriculums. Very questionable.
Where do you think the woke like agenda comes from? Is it from the teachers? Is it from the Prime Minister? Is it from the students themselves?
I think why people, and this is the question I've asked, why are they so accepting of certain change? Why aren't people questioning a lot of stuff, especially in education where young people are meant to be asking these questions, are meant to be talking about things.
University's about.
That's exactly what it should be about. But what we've seen is there's been a lot of suppression when it comes to certain topics, especially in, I've seen it in schools. There's one
in universities, a lot of suppression.
I think it's all across the education establishment.
Can you give us an example of like when this got suppressed, like free speech is suppressed?
So if we've seen it in universities all across the country. We've seen stories where people have been kicked out of lecture halls. They've been told they've been on. They've been made complaints.
For doing what?
Well, as simple as expressing a certain political affiliation.
What sort of like affiliation? Well, like supporting reform, like kicked out of uni for supporting reform.
Not just supporting reform, but maybe you were pro-Christian or you had...
Christians have been kicked out for being Christian.
No, but this is my point, is that there has been many complaints across this country, especially in our education establishments, and it's becoming too political. And this is my point. You need to step out of that, out of suppressing people from whatever walk of life, whatever political affiliation. This is my point. It's not about whether they're kicking out for reform or Palestine. It doesn't matter which side of the scale you're on. And this is what people are getting too hung up on, is, oh, you're getting kicked out for reform or you get kicked out because of Labour. It's not about that. It's about you getting kicked out full stop. And that's what needs to stop. You need to be able to have that freedom of speech, freedom of expression, freedom of thought, and not be thinking, oh, I might not be able to say that. If you say, especially in schools, if you say things and it might not, you know, the people might not agree around it, then your peers will say, no, that was inappropriate. You don't then need disciplinary action. I think it's too far.
Where's the line for that? Because there is a certain line where something becomes hate speech, right? And like, it's an interesting question. Yeah, yeah. Where does that sit for you? Yeah. When should we tell someone off in school for what they say? What's an example of the
thing? I think what we need to, and this is the thing, I think what we need to realise is that especially young people, they are evolving comedically as a person. They are going to say things. And when it does reach a certain threshold, yes, fair enough, you will go down that.
But is that threshold? Like just, you know.
Well, when you start being... And what I've seen, especially in schools in my neck of the woods, it's very different to where it is in other parts of the country. You know, if you're just making a joke,
a joke about, let's say a casual joke about black people, would that be all right?
No, I don't think that would be appropriate. I think what people need to realise is that children are exploring themselves. Comedically and things, they're gonna cross the line. You know, it's inevitable.
So if someone makes a race joke, should they get disciplinary action?
I think
probably.
Well, when it comes to things like that, you have to realize is that you have to take it on a common sense level, as in they are young people, but you do need to have that conversation with them. That basic conversation.
That's what a conversation is, right? Discipline.
Yeah, well, like for instance, you know, if you pushed your mate in the corridor, you know, and you just, you know, I'm a bit stronger than you, you're a bit stronger than me, and you push him a bit too much and he falls and knocks the bin over, you know, your teacher will tell you off and then you'll realise, oh, best not do that again. It's things like that. But you shouldn't then get the whole book thrown at you, which I've seen in schools myself, where it has been a bit over the top with other things as well. And I think we just need to look at, we just have to go back to the basics. And it's not, again, about certain jokes. It's just when it comes down to, you need to realise that these are children at the end of the day. And a lot of this stuff, and I'll bring it back on to, I'll bring it onto parenting as well soon enough. But what we need to realise is that when it comes to education, especially teachers as well, you know, that they are the kind of unsung heroes in a sense of making these children explore through books and literature and all of the aspects of education, which is amazing. You know, I had some really great teachers that expanded the whole class's mind. And when you did have that debate, they were quite allowing of the political views, and that was great. And especially in sixth form, when you were learning A-level politics, it's great for people to express that. So that's why what we have to do is, you know, install British values back into schools. I think you have to take some sort of common sense approach to a lot of things.
Difficulty with common sense, instance, right, is it's not something you can really define when it comes to these things, right? Saying, let's take a common sense issue. Let's look at specific issues in order to explore, like, what you mean by common sense, for example, right?
Yeah, well...
Like primary school curriculums, you said. Yeah, when the stuff is shocking. What's on the curriculum that's shocking?
Yeah, when a six-year-old... Mm-hmm. In PHSE, is in the curriculum, it says for year 6 to 7 that they need to ask, say, little Timmy. Little Timmy's asked what he doesn't like about being a boy and what he'd prefer about being a girl. Do you think that's appropriate?
And is that mandated in UK curriculums?
That's in the PHSE curriculum that this school has taken on. Now,
just one school?
And this is the thing, this is what we're doing. As I said, we're getting our feet under the table. And this is the point about what we're doing on Warwickshire County Council. And this is why I said, about schools is we're going through all these PHSE, especially primary school curriculums, and just looking through them on a common sense basis. Do you think that's right? Probably not. Mm-hmm. Maybe when they're older, I'm not really bothered, but not at that age. And this is the point that we're making, is that that's not appropriate at that age. And I think no one can disagree with that. And that's then things, and you go, well, I will explore PHSE curriculum. Oh, I found this one. That's a bit shocking. A resident come up to me and they showed me the curriculum. I went, God, that's a bit, come on. Mm-hmm. So surely not. And then they sent it to me and I looked at it and read through it and I was shocked. So then what we're going to do, what we've got the education portfolio holder to do, is go through them and just have a look. Maybe it's only that one school. But if it is, we ain't got powers over the education system in Warwickshire. County councils rarely do nowadays because it's been academised. Another thing Tony Blair did. But
actually, that was the Conservative
government. No. Tony Blair did start the academisation of schools. Tony Blair did begin those.
We can fact check that after, don't worry.
But it's the same with the universities and the polytechnics. Another thing, it was this major change. Michael Gove did start edging the way through with academisation, but it was mentioned and the ball got rolling. Same with the privatisation of the NHS through Tony Blair. But this is the thing, is that bring it back onto education, is that what we're finding is what I'm getting the portfolio holders to look at is those things, to question it. And if we do find something, then I think it's a conversation that should be had between the portfolio holder and the head teacher or the CEO of the trust. I think it's something that, things that, your counsellors should be looking at. So I'm looking forward to have a look, looking through these curriculums and see if there is anything. If there's not, great. Well done to them.
So there's two things I'm taking from this. One of which, in terms of like your approach to this kind of issue, you've mentioned two things. So common sense, which I think is somewhat hard to define, but I understand where you're coming from. And the other one is British values. What are British values?
Well, it's, for instance, the things you have, tolerance, your British history as well is a big one. And that's where going through the history departments in schools is, history isn't being taught the way that I believe personally it should be. And especially
what's the aim of historical teaching? British values, British achievement in England? Is that the idea?
I think, for instance, what I've seen, again, personal opinion, going through the education system, being taught history, you get hounded that the British Empire was bad, 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 bad. And yes, did bad things. Fair enough, and it did. And you have to
concentration camps is one of them, for example.
You have to accept those bad things that they did.
Yeah, exactly.
Slavery,
concentration camps.
Yeah, of course. Though Britain was one of the ones, once they did slavery, then they took it back and changed, and then the biggest fighting forces against it. But you have to accept that. But then you have to also look at the other things that they were successful for. And this is the thing. You're in Britain, and everyone is not seeing the great that this country has done. And that's the point about pushing our Britishness through schools, British values. Look how well we've done as a country. Look what we've created across the world. And yes, we have done bad things. Every country has.
Well, I'm from Malta. Would you say that the kind of actions of Britain are comparable to the bad actions of Malta, a tiny country in the Mediterranean?
I'm saying all countries have done
in scale,
questionable
right?
thing. Bigger countries.
Concentration camps and slavery. I think there's like that scales to it, right?
Yeah, they are bad things. I'm not saying they're not. Yeah, right. That would be crazy to say so.
I think his point is that Britain has done a lot of bad things.
They should get taught.
And
but what should also get taught is the good things that we did.
Of course, yeah.
The amazing things that
I'd say so.
And that's what's not being taught. And I've seen it personally, myself.
Were you taught the good things?
So I was about to bring that up. I mean, like, from what I remember from learning history at school, if I'm honest, actually, if anything, I was undertaught the negatives of the British Empire. And actually, we were learning about, for example, importation of tea from different countries that we got and all the ways that Britain benefited and things like that. And so actually it seems there was a skewering towards the good. But I just want to focus on the British values thing for a second. You said tolerance is one of the British values. I think a lot of countries have that value, but if you could be more specific, what does tolerance look like?
It's for me, it's about promoting the British values within our schools. You know, I think.
But what are these values?
I know, it's, you know, I think what we need to do, you know, when I was taught at school, it was tolerance, respect, things that make us British. You know, and I think what
those are like human values rather than just British values.
I think what we're seeing is that in schools, there has been a decline of, and I spoke to a teacher a few days ago, in my role as children and families. I went and spoke to her, and she said that when she was at school, parents were more hands on with their children, and now she, you know, another head teacher, she said to me that schools have become somewhat of a babysitting place, and I was like, I can see where you're coming from with that. And it goes back to those British values, is that as a family unit, you know, and I could spout on about many other things when it comes to families, you know, adult social care. Should the family kind of take on the role of looking after the grandparent, like the Sikh community normally does and the Muslim communities do? Should we do that? Because I think that's been broken up significantly.
Well, British values.
I think we should look after our elderly, and have more.
I agree with that. And I think that's good for sure.
And this is where I think this is what these head teachers were talking to me about, especially in the north of the county when it's more deprived. I don't know if you've looked at Warwickshire. When it comes to the north, where I'm from, they are crying out for money and support.
The send issues are huge right now. I think that's one of the biggest.
Yeah, and what we're trying to bridge that gap is that how do we help these schools? Teachers, families, it's a massive problem.
You need money.
Not just money, though.
But it's a big part of it, right?
Of course it is.
I know that Warwickshire recently like asked the government for help, right?
Yeah,
that was
reform.
Well, exactly. So where did we get that money? I guess that's the next question.
In county councils, under the Tory government, they allowed councils to get in a thing called a statutory override. And that is kind of a separate pot of money that councils are allowed to go into, say, debting.
Yeah, but Warwickshire doesn't have a big statutory override, my understanding.
Yes, it does.
It does.
87.
But no debt.
£87 million.
But no debt, is it?
It's solvent. That can get paid off in the financial plan. That 87
okay, two
can
separate
go.
Issues then.
But next year, that send deficit, statutory override goes up to £187 million, with £50 million a year spent on home to school transport. Separate pot of money, £50 million. At 187 million, it's growing. It's not sustainable.
No.
So I think, you know, taxi companies are ripping us off.
I've heard that it's actually massive, the taxis. I know, and not only in Warwickshire, I think around the country.
Oh, no, around the country. But and this is the point that I'm looking at.
Of course, Warwickshire's
perspective.
Yeah, of course.
What we can make sure we get a better deal for the people of Warwickshire. And that's a big one that I'm looking at tackling with the education portfolio and the highways portfolio. Is there things that needs to be done? To make sure that, and this is what I found, is these companies that jump on, you know, these taxi companies, they're just rinsing councils because they know that they have to pay because it's a statutory requirement. These taxi companies go, yeah, they have to pay for that child to go to school. You know, let's just charge them, you know, X amount of money, and it blows the bank. Same with children care homes, another huge one, private children care homes. The council are being charged £6,000 per child per week. If the county council did it, £3,000 per child per week. Now, see how that will save money instantly. But, you know, it's not so simple. There are things that I've been looking at doing, but it's a long term. But again, you need those carers, and there's not a magic carers tree. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So apprenticeships would be a way to bridge that gap.
Basically, money is needed as well, right?
I'm not saying it isn't.
And no, for sure. That's not in contradiction. I'm just saying, like, this is the root of the problem, right? Obviously, people need to be trained and so on and so forth, but most councils aren't doing well financially. You know, the government is in debt. Now, if we look at reforms policy then as it comes to generating money for the government and tax, first of all, I really agree with raising the bottom rate of tax to 20,000 from 12,000. I think, like, if anyone in society is going to be contributing, it shouldn't be the people who are, you know, have to live off £15,000 a year. But there are a significant series of tax cuts, for example, on inheritance tax, and so on and so forth. And the calculated total apparently comes to about £75 billion in tax cuts on reforms policy. Now, how do you balance the books with that kind of deficit from the tax cuts? Mm-hmm. We already have a deficit. Reform is proposing tax cuts. Where does the money come from?
I think what you're basing those things off was the manifesto from 2024. I think the financial situation of the country has changed. But when it comes to, you know, just those things that we mentioned in 2024, the tax, increasing the tax threshold to £20,000, that really helps the people, especially in my areas of Bedworth and Nuneaton. But how you pay for that is what I found is, and on county councils as well, but in national government, you know, we look at going on saving money. You know, we can't just be splashing cash everywhere there isn't. And I think what Zia Yusuf really eloquently put, which is amazing, you know, you shouldn't hear the same words benefit and Mercedes in one, you know, and the bill is increasing on unemployment benefits, disability benefits, the welfare bill. That doesn't mean, and I'm not saying we cut disabled people's benefits, because that's exactly not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is we have to look at it in a different lens. Same with homeschool transport. If you start saving money on the councils, then in turn it saves the government money. And then when you go into, and then once we create those recipes, as you will, or methods, we can then take that to national government and cut things like net zero. As a party, you probably know, we believe that it's not sustainable. Yes, we want a nice green country. That's got nice wildlife, nice, you know, ecosystems and so on. You're not going to be, you know, blundering the planet, but we're saying net zero, it's the zero bit you can't achieve, and you can't achieve it that quickly. But also, compared to the rest of the world, it's a drop in the ocean. You know, look at China, Brazil, America, India, spewing all these things out. And if
it's
we
the principle,
start,
I suppose, but,
if, but
it's a collective action problem, though, right? Because if
what,
we go,
0.01%, like,
if we go, as a country, oh, we don't care about net zero. It's these other big countries, and they go, we don't care. It's, you know, we're only one country amongst many
Britain's
others.
Got a lot of soft
they
power.
Need to do it. You know, Britain has a lot of soft power. That's true, and also every country would have to individually choose to do it in order for climate change, in the sense of changing our practices so as to protect the climate. That clearly needs to happen, at least to some extent. But if every country is kind of going, well, it's all these other countries, you end up with a problem where, because everyone's worried about the others not doing it, nobody is making effective change. So isn't it kind of just, you know, it's kind of bad faith almost in a way.
I think going on to your point about the UK having soft power, we did. I believe that nowadays, getting Keir Starmer in
I think the Trump state visit showed some soft power.
The monarch.
Well, that's
Britain, absolutely.
Right? Well, that is England, right?
No, but my point is, sending Keir Starmer out on the world stage doesn't fill anyone with hope. And I think Nigel Farage can really, when he is prime minister, I do genuinely believe that when he does, and he is around other world leaders, that we can get finally putting Britain back on the world stage.
My point was that Britain has soft power, let's say, in relation to Lithuania, Comoros, Ecuador, you know.
Right, yeah.
They do, right?
Yeah, well, my point is that when it comes to those big countries that are spewing out climate, you know, greenhouse gases, is that if we start and we, in effect, bankrupt our own people because of it. It's not sustainable.
One of the big countries, for example, is America, right? And somebody who's particularly keen on America being less hard on climate change is Donald Trump, who
drill
Nigel
baby
Farage
drill.
Is and exactly drill baby drill. Who Nigel Farage is a big fan of. So it's not really just about the fact that we're opting out because we're a smaller country. It's actually a bit of, you know, given the fact that Nigel supports Trump, that shows to some extent that it's not just about the fact that we're a small country.
Nigel's
but actually
been saying this way before Trump got on the scene. Nigel was saying
for sure,
this years
but
before.
I'm not saying about who said it first. I'm saying your argument was that it's the bigger countries that we should be concerned about. And yet the leader of your party supports somebody who comes from one of those bigger countries. In fact, you know, one of the biggest, and supports them being less hard on climate change as well. So it's not really just about the fact that the UK is small, but actually it's the fact that, you know, clearly reform doesn't care about the climate quite as much.
It's
a fair assessment, isn't it?
It's not sustainable for our people in the poorest areas of our country. You know, like the Green Party were screaming about external wall insulation, that the county council should pay for that. You know, no, we shouldn't. It doesn't work. If you're in construction, you'll know that the way councils do external wall insulation is not fit for purpose. They stick it on all four walls, but they don't, well, that's if it's detached, but they stick it on the walls, but they don't do underfloor and ceiling. It leaks in the cold air and completely wastes all your money and everything, because there's no point. Your heat goes because of these concrete no-find houses, old coal mining towns, the bricks up to about here, then it's concrete poured. It seeps through the walls and the roof. So it's a complete waste of money if you're going to try and go green or put external wall insulation.
There are ways of going green properly. That work, right?
Well, I think what we found is, and I was speaking to some developers today about stuff in a few days, is when they build these huge warehouses, they do make sure that there's that eco-diversity and things like that, biodiversity, sorry. And there's that natural habitat and environment and things. Wonderful. Yeah, make it look lovely. Don't just throw a bag of rubbish up. It's same with these new build houses. God, they just throw a load of houses up and they don't actually care about what they, you know, do they fit? Is the infrastructure there? But going back to the green issues, is as a party, we do recognise that we do want our rivers clean, our seas clean. We do want those things. Again, who wouldn't? Yeah, you know, it's common sense, isn't it?
I would say so.
And there's ways of going about that. But when it comes to the bigger picture, that's on a global scale, and the amount of emissions we spew into the world compared to others, is that I believe we shouldn't be financially burdening our own people in going that way when there's other countries doing it. You know, we just let's make sure we're actually economically sound, then maybe you have the luxury of doing things like that. And that's my argument on the council. Once you become all this lovey-dovey and you've got a great economy, you've got thousands of pounds in your back pocket and everyone's on lilos, then maybe you can start doing those luxury things. But you don't have.
Is it a luxury? I mean, when are we ever going to get to that point?
Well, there's a point.
We can't ignore the climate forever. And yet, Nigel Farage, the leader of the party, like I said, supports somebody who also thinks it's a luxury to care about the climate, Donald Trump. So it's not really just about the fact that, you know, we're not eventually getting around to it. You know, our economy isn't strong enough. I think also it's the fact that simply at the end of the day, Reform maybe is a party that cares a bit less, which is, is fine as an argument. But
my people in Bedworth can't afford a block of butter, a block of cheese. They can't afford it because they have to pay for these types of things.
Is that the reason?
What do you mean?
Is it a direct cause? I think the reason they can't afford it is because the cost of living has gone up so much. But we need to look at grand GDP and the percentages of where the costs are actually going. I'm not sure that climate change action is the largest, you know, source from which money is being taken.
Mm. Well, what I was about to say is that my people in Bedworth can't afford a block of cheese. Butter, right?
Right.
Now, they can't afford that. And they can't afford their other bills. So you can't then ask them to pay for more external wall insulation on councils, which isn't sustainable. It's a waste of money. Mm. So for them to knock at the county council's door that hasn't got enough money to spend on children with disabilities and asking for external wall insulation that doesn't work, that is a waste of money, not our priority, and it should be the district and borough's job. But because they're squandering all the money on these terrible local plans, they come knocking at our door.
Fair enough, the organisation might not be there, but maybe that's the council needs to look at where the money is going and how it's being split up. Fair enough.
They have to look at their priorities. And
I don't know if it's a question about priority. I think that, you know, what we need to look at is, why is this cost of living going up so strongly? Mm. And I'm not sure that it is because of net zero action. I really, really don't think that's the reason.
It's just that. I'm not saying there's many factors, but that is one to play. And if you start knocking them off one by one, it's cheaper. But if you just go, no, or it's definitely economic stability, interest rates and so on, it's not just that. There's many effects. So if you keep knocking them off and saving and making efficiencies, you are making sure that there's a better deal for the people. If you say, well, I've saved X, Y, and Z, you know, on the county council, we're putting the value for money program. We're looking at saving 20 million in the first year that we're in, and then equivalent of 50 million over the next 2 to 3 years. Now, that's what we're doing for the people of Warwickshire, making sure that there is savings. And the first things we will be looking at is DEI, spend net zero, and other things that you can do. And that's why I believe you have to get your priorities right, which is supporting children with SEND needs, you know, making sure the locality's there. Local government reorganisation would be a great one to save a lot of money on staff and so on, and duplication of services. Adult social care is a big one. It's 68% of our 60% of our budget. 68% of our budget, adult social care. Children's services is about 20-odd% of our budget. It's massive. Our councils are more of a service now, and that's what people need to understand. It's changed from years ago. It's changed significantly, and that's where services we have to provide for these people, and that's our priority. Making sure children have the best outcome, and the way we do that,
and a future is, and a green planet,
and the way, well, give them a job first and an apprentice. That's what I'm saying. Let them earn some money.
Maybe both.
Let them earn some money. Then they might be able to start doing things maybe, in the future. Yeah. Once they're not homeless, or you know, they haven't got an affordable housing, because you know the cost of them's rising, because again they're sticking all these modifications up that you don't need on these houses.
Well, maybe so incorrectly done.
No. I'm not about that. As in modifications, in 2 en-suites, 4 beds, massive gardens.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
You know, I'm saying more affordable housing, like I said.
Yeah, so it's
things like that that we have to look at. And Nigel's rightly said that's what we need to look at. And, you know, Reform is the party of the future. You've seen Labour and the Conservatives throughout years fail. They failed a lot of people, and people have really turned their back on those two parties. And it leaves us now to pick up the pieces and start governing on councils where it has failed. Now,
So Reform is definitely different. It's definitely a break in the political faction. I agree with you that far. Something that we haven't gotten into yet, but I think, you know, Reform has basically, by and large, built its platform off and is one of its biggest diagnoses of problems in the UK as well, is migration. So how big is the economic impact of migration in the UK?
I think what we're seeing is, and I always bring it back to my town, right, Bedworth. I always bring it back to Bedworth because that is your average town. You know, it's got areas of deprivation and areas of affluence. So I always bring it back to that. And when it comes to immigration, we are seeing that people in Bedworth can't go to the GP. And it all comes down to economics at the end of the day. They can't go to GP. They can't get a dentist. There's too many people. And when I was speaking to some resident, it made sense. Why would you throw a party for 30 people and have a buffet for 30 people where everyone can have a decent plate of food, of services? You know, it's an analogy. And then 100 people just show up at the door and you just let them in. And then everyone's got
What if they're all caterers?
Sorry?
What if they're all caterers?
Well, they're not, though, are they?
Well, nice analogy. Well, I mean, like, you know, the NHS relies a lot on migration. 16%, for example, of NHS workers are foreign-born non-nationals of the UK. So actually, I think if you look at you, it is about economics, you're right. And, you know, anecdotal stuff is important as well. But strictly, if you look at the economic data, there was a study done in 2023, for example, by the Migration Observatory, which does, you know, in-depth social scientific studies on this kind of thing, found that migration overall in the UK year to year has roughly a +1 or -1% impact on the GDP of the UK. That's a really small amount, actually. So it doesn't seem like it's the primary problem with services. Maybe it's austerity. Maybe it's inflation. But the data literally tells us that legal migration, at least, has a +1% impact on the GDP of the UK as a whole. So how can we say that it is immigration,
well,
which is
now
causing
these
problems?
Now we're getting specifics. Yeah. Legal migration. Before, you never mentioned which one.
I'm happy to talk about both, but
legal,
if we can just stick on legal for
legal,
a second.
Legal. Yeah. And I believe what Australia's done is probably the best way to go about it, a point system. We want to make sure that
we do have a point system right now.
No, but this very similar to the Australian point system. Well, I'm not saying I never said we didn't. What I'm saying is we need to have one like the Australian system. I think it will work the best way.
Can you explain it for listeners, maybe? Just explain
the difference between our current one.
So for instance, when it comes to Australia, you have to earn over a certain amount of money. You have to speak the language.
Well, that gives you points as well. Those are actually mandatory in the British point system. No. The three mandatory ones in the British point system, if you don't mind, are that you speak English, that you have sponsorship by a certain employer. And I'm forgetting the third one. And I think it's a wage of 23 and above or something is the last mandatory one. And then you have non-mandatory ones, which help as well, like a PhD or something like that. So actually, strictly, to get a working visa in the UK for legal migration, you do have to speak English. We do kind of have the Australian system, don't we?
I think when it comes to legal immigration, is that it's about, again, it's about priorities for us. And we've seen that the British people have not been the priority for a long time.
How exactly?
For instance, and this is what never made sense to me. Tony Blair said, you know, freedom of movement, right? And he said, you can, that famous quote, you can have breakfast in, Paris, lunch in London, and then dinner in Rome, something like that. That's great when it's the middle class. That's great when it's the rich elite. But when you come to people of Bedworth that don't have a passport and can't travel and can't even afford to get there, it's not economically viable. And you've got a lot more people coming in than going out, in the sense of workers. So there's people coming in. And what we need to realise is, it goes down to what I was saying, apprenticeships. If we want to make sure our people have the best shot in life, put them first.
But we've just established that the economic impact is, in many, you know, by and large,
negligible.
Actually quite negligible. And that often, because of the points-based system which we now have, which we've also established is actually quite similar to the Australian one, what we have a lot of the time is positive impact because of migration. So I completely understand your point, by the way, okay? Cost of living is completely out of control. That we agree on, you know, and people need to be able to put food on their plate. But the data tells us that migration really isn't the thing which is causing that. So why is it such a big focus for reform?
It's a big issue for everybody because you're seeing, you know, and I always bring it back to my town, is that when we have big issues, cultural changes that people haven't seen before. And what they need to remember is that when it comes to the NHS, schools, send demand, the councils can't cope. And that's where we have to understand that there's children that have got disabilities, that have got autism and send needs, that we have to support and prioritise. And there's a lot of people coming over that, I'm sorry, we just don't have the money for. We have to make sure that
illegal or legal?
No, both. We don't. Yeah, you know, we're not the prosperous country we once were, and I wish we were. But, don't get me wrong. I wish we were. Yeah. When we start having all these luxury things,
we've just established. I'm sorry to reiterate the point, but we've just established that legal migration is not actually is quite a negligible effect on the economy. And B, the average legal immigrant actually has a net positive impact on the UK,
you can look at so many studies regarding this, but what I'm saying is that what we see...
facts lie, right? Because all you're identifying when it comes to your town is the cost of living.
Because it's not just that. You come to Bedworth, I invite you to come to Bedworth, and you speak to the people and hear what they say to you. They will mention many factors of why the town's completely gone wrong. But we're seeing that there's these changes that they're seeing. Turkish barbers popping up, nail barber shops.
Is that what's causing the cost of living crisis?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying
right,
that
was there two separate issues. What I'm saying is... We don't want to mix it up for this conversation.
But what I'm saying is that there's a lot of changes that people need to understand.
Yeah.
And when we have to start funding things, for instance, the things that illegal and legal immigrants get that we have to pay for and support for, well, benefits. I was watching a thing about Dubai, and actually, you know, you're not allowed any benefits when you go over. You have to have, you know, certain things like a sponsor and so on, but you get no benefits, no voting rights, no citizenship. You can't own property.
As a legal migrant, I have no benefits.
No, but you can.
No, only if I actually stay here and get settled status.
Yeah, no, but this is my point.
It will take me 10 years, right? By then I would have generated X amount of money for the economy and so on.
But my point is that what we have to remember is that this country is, it's not what it used to be. And this is where
a cultural point now? Are we having a cultural discussion? Because you mentioned Turkish barbers, for example.
I'm on about economics. Hmm. Is that it's not what it used to be. It doesn't have that money in the bank anymore. We have to get the bricks and mortar stuff right. and then we can start looking at other things. My stance is on the county council. We don't do much immigration stuff. That's not my remit, you know, but as a party policy, I imagine other people can talk for days about this. I'm focusing on SEND provision, adult social care and children's services. You know, we do very little when it comes to immigration. Statutory requirements for unaccompanied asylum seeker children. And, you know, come on, I'm not taking that offshore. I can't anyway, and I wouldn't want to because you have to support those people. But when it comes to those type of things, it's not on my day-to-day calendar, not on my day-to-day emails, because people actually in my town recognise the things that we're seeing is that we need to make sure we get the proper stuff right. And I'm not talking about immigration at the moment. I'm talking about getting the proper stuff right. Adult social care. Look at the Lib Dems, right? They've got this great strategy about adult social care, children's services. They keep shouting to the roofs about it. We need to start looking at these things too as a party. And that's what we're doing in local government, is understanding these types of things. Yeah, we're pretty new, yeah. And we understand these things now. EHCP, SEND provision, specialist provision when it comes to primary schools, all these things that we're learning. You know, the councils all across the country. I've got a sister with SEND, so I know a bit more. But that's the priorities that we have to start tackling. And when it comes to immigration, we can have this debate in 2-3 years' time at the general election. But frankly, you know, it's not one of my priorities at the moment, because I do get it, you know, that reforms, policies, you know, we have got a big one on immigration, but we've also got one on the cost of living, social housing. And as it develops, yeah, we're a new party. Yeah, we're developing all of our policies as we go along. We're creating new ones by the day, you know. And it's like in Warwickshire, we declared our SEND emergency, saying that we don't have the money in the pot. We don't. And that's the thing. We have to keep going to the national government. And that's what it was with the statutory override, is that it should actually be the national government that pays for this. But we've took that hit for, and that was because of the Tories, but we took that hit. So now we're kind of, giving us money back. They won't. The fair funding review we're reviewing at the moment, see if that works. But local government reorganisation is the last chance, really, of major local government change that we'll see. And that'll be a generation change thing. And I don't even know if that'll work.
Right. Well, look, George, thanks very much for your time. Do you have any kind of closing thoughts after this?
Well, I just think, you know, our priorities on Warwickshire County Council is to make sure that the services are done properly, to make sure that the bricks and mortar stuff, the bread and butter stuff's there for the most vulnerable people, children with SEND needs, you know, disabled adults, disabled children, getting the potholes filled, you know, transport and planning is a major one, huge infrastructure changes, local government reorganisation, town centre redevelopment. One of my main ones is apprenticeships. You know, these are the things that reform are now talking about and we are developing things on. You know, and this is where the press need to start looking at those type of things. Ask us more about those, the things that we're actually looking at on a day-to-day basis, because you'll find some really interesting stuff coming out of all councils across the country. And, you know, this is the thing now. We are in government all across the country. We're not yet in national government, but we are local.
That's true.
It will just be a matter of time until we become the largest party, or Nigel Farage's prime minister. I can't wait for that. I think that'll be really debatable. Good.
I don't know if I'd agree, but if you don't mind, I just want to ask, genuinely out of interest, I think, like, you're right. In the general political discussion in the UK, right, the focus is national government.
Yeah.
Break down the differences in terms of impact, maybe, between local and national government. Because growing up, I've always thought about, okay, you know, who's sitting on the, you know, who's prime minister? Maybe I just haven't interacted with councillors enough, but I've never really had that experience.
You're probably right.
What's the difference?
You're probably right there, is that a lot of people don't see local councillors. They don't know that they're local councillors, but not just young people. Adults go through their whole life not knowing what local government does. Mm. But you know, it breaks up in two things. You've got the borough and your districts that do bins, planning, local development, and you've got the county council that deal with adult social care, children's services, education, not anymore, but they used to, SEND, highways, transport planning, local economy, finance and property, heritage and culture, And that's the kind of things that need to be highlighted. But for too long, local government have been underinvested, underfunded, and they've come to the point where they'll be knocking on the door in a few years going, time's up, we don't have the money. And that's the danger that we're at. Once local government crumbles, national government can't stand. And national government need to help us out to be able to fund the local services that the people need on a day-to-day basis. National government, unfortunately, we're at their peril. That's the scariest part.
Well, look, George, we'll be following your story closely. Hopefully you can make Warwickshire a better place. I think we can all agree on that. Thank you very much for joining us for the conversation today. We had a good time. For all those listening or watching, thank you for tuning in. You can subscribe to this channel for more content just like this.